This Dharma talk by Mayor Chapman was recorded on December 15th, 2017 at the Women's Retreat at Holy Wisdom Monastery in Middleton, Wisconsin.
Good evening. Tonight I'd like to explore the landscape of fear, to understand it more deeply and remind us how the teachings in mindfulness can help us relate to it wisely so we can be less afraid of it. Then tomorrow night, I'll delve into how we can cultivate courage and nourish our brave hearts so we can live more joyfully when fear is our companion. How do you feel about fear? I really don't like it myself. It's very, very unpleasant. We'd rather keep it at arm's length or eliminate it altogether because it's so uncomfortable. I mean, just being on retreat, not knowing what will happen over the next couple of days can provoke it. What if something really hard comes up that I'm not ready to handle? What if that pain returns and gets really bad and I can't stand it? And what's going on at home or work about me being there? Are things falling apart? Is everybody okay? Fear is as human as laughter and tears. It's a universal experience. All creatures feel it, and it's frequently so close at hand. Even when we feel joyful, there's often fear behind our joy. We fear this beautiful moment will end, that we won't get what we need, that we'll lose what we love, or we won't be safe. The human condition is scary. I mean, let's face it, loss, pain, and death are guaranteed the moment we're born. Also is uncertainty, helplessness, vulnerability, and chaos. And given these terribly turbulent times we're living right now, fear is dialed up for most of us. Though the world has always been troubled, humans have fought wars, faced injustice, struggled to survive, dealt with violence and greed, and felt powerless pretty much forever. Except we now have the capacity to create disaster on a global scale to the degree that we're threatening the continuation of life on the planet. On top of our own personal challenges, this continual bombardment can feel overwhelming and seep in so deeply that it colors our mood, affects our bodies, our health, and our relationships. Yet these are the conditions we have now. And if we can accept things as they are, then the question becomes, how can we find the wise middle way? After all, the teachings extol fearlessness as a virtue for us spiritual warriors and say that we cultivate fearlessness in the face of fear. A card on the bulletin board in my office has a quote from the Tao that inspires me daily. Whoever can see through all fear will always be safe. Whoever can see through all fear will always be safe. Sometimes the possibility of fearlessness seems so far away from me, I wonder if it's really attainable. Yet it's heartening to realize that we're practicing fearlessness every time we meditate. We're opening to the unknown of the next moment over and over. This is encouraging. Clearly, in these very troubled times, it's vital to learn to relate skillfully to what scares us so we can respond wisely, make the most of our precious lives, do what we actually can do to help, and keep growing our hearts in wisdom for the benefit of all. So what is fear? Fear is a mind state, an emotion of alarm, a state of heightened arousal caused by the expectation or the experience of danger. We feel fear whenever we perceive the threat of loss or harm to our body, mind, or spirit. We feel whenever we perceive the threat of loss or harm to our body, mind, or spirit. It's a future event appearing real, F-E-A-R. It's our emotional warning system that's wisely built into our biology. It's a wake-up call that says, hey, pay attention. Its purpose is to move us to action to protect life. It's part of our deepest instinct for survival. Fear has inherent intelligence. And it comes in many intensities, ranging from mild nervousness, apprehension, worry, and anxiety, to more severe states like panic attacks, PTSD, obsessive-compulsive disorders, and phobias. It can be a temporary mind state, and it can become chronic and prolonged. It's estimated that at least 20% of the population is diagnosed with some kind of anxiety disorder. And feeling anxiety seems epidemic in our culture now. When we're caught in fear, our mind is imagining a scary story, and depending on the intensity of that story, our body responds by pumping adrenaline, heart rate and blood pressure increase, muscles tighten, we feel butterflies or a knot in our stomach, and we close our heart in protection. The amygdala, the guard dog of the brain, is activated, and the wise owl of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, is dimmed, making us primed to act and defend ourselves, but without access to our usual common sense. Mentally, fear gives us tunnel vision, making us less likely to see things clearly or discover other possibilities. And access to our true nature, our open, wise, stable mind and heart, gets cut off. Although occasionally exciting, like when you're riding a roller coaster at the fair, its sensations are very unpleasant. And because fear is so darn unpleasant, we feel lots of aversion to it. We resist it, deny it, we go numb to it, all of which contributes to staying caught in it. And on top of that, if we judge ourselves for feeling afraid, then we add the second arrow of shame and embarrassment to our already painful experience. It's no wonder we're afraid of fear. Poor us, really, my oh my. Fear is tough. But where does fear come from? What are its roots? Thich Nhat Hanh says that at the moment of our birth, coming out of our mother's womb where we're safe and comfortable, being thrust into a new environment, suddenly feeling cold, seeing bright lights, hearing loud sounds, and having to breathe on our own for the very first time, we felt our very first fear, our original fear. And at the same moment, we felt our very first desire, the desire to survive. And even though we are now all grown up, deep down we may still fear that we can't survive, that no one will take care of us. It's possible that every desire we have in our lives is rooted in this fundamental fear that we won't survive. So it's normal and important to feel fear. It's useful and necessary. It keeps our species going. There is no existence in life without it. I find this comforting. We all need a good dose of healthy fear to navigate our way through the shoals of life. If we were totally fearless, we would be in terrible danger without knowing it. There's a story about a monastery in the mountains in China where deer would come into the grounds of the monastery and graze. The monks loved the deer and enjoyed feeding them. But when the abbot heard the monks were feeding the deer, he came running out, shouting and waving his arms, and began attacking the deer with a big stick. The deer became frightened and ran away. Then he put up a sign saying, "No more feeding the deer," and all deer in the property were to be chased away. The monks were confused and protested, saying they came to the monastery to learn kindness and compassion, and told the abbot he was setting a bad example. The abbot responded by saying, "Because there were hunters in the mountains, the only defense the deer had from them was their fear." He said that if they took that away from them, they would all be killed very soon. They need to feel fear in order to keep themselves safe. Even though we're not deer in danger of being killed, there are so many things that appear to threaten our security. It's true that at some moment we won't survive. Our bodies will die. This is nature, and we are nature. But between now and that final moment, so many different things can threaten us. And what scares me may well be different than what scares you. Perhaps it's flying in airplanes, or public speaking, heights, physical pain, intimacy, aging, poor health, being alone, or losing loved ones. Beginnings, endings, and transitions can feel scary. Any kind of change can feel threatening to the status quo. We could say some fears are more rational than others. Global warming and its destructive effects, the threat of nuclear disasters, terrorism, the destabilizing political polarizations around the world are certainly rational fears. Although they're global threats, we feel them individually. We feel threatened by the breakdown of laws and behaviors that promote democracy, social justice, and human decency. When the threat is personal, you or your loved one gets a cancer diagnosis, your employer is sexually harassing you, you lose your job, your daughter has anorexia, or your loved one is dying, the fear that arises is rational. It's intelligent to feel fear in these conditions. Many of our fears, though, arise from deeply held conditioned beliefs about ourselves and others, born from the messages and traumas from our families and culture. Fears of gender, racial, class, and religious differences, fears about ourselves, that we're not how we're supposed to be, and fears about others, that they'll harm us and can't be trusted, are all rooted in our conditioning. These are hardwired, deep neural grooves in our brains. Bottom line, though, our ultimate fear may be that whatever it is that scares us, we're afraid we won't be able to handle it. We fear we'll be totally undone by it, permanently. Even though these fears are created in our minds rather than externally generated, they're just as important. Their ability to disable us is just as profound, if not greater. It's well documented that women worry and feel fear much more than men do. In fact, mental health statistics year after year tell us we experience more than twice as much anxiety than men. Why is this? It's certainly not because we're inherently neurotic, weak, or crazy. We come by it legitimately. It's a natural product of our gender conditioning. Born into the subordinate position in our patriarchal capitalistic world, we're viewed as weaker, less important, less intelligent, and less capable than men. Because we unknowingly internalize these oppressive sexist views, we form a self-identity that views ourselves as lesser and flawed. We come to believe we aren't good enough, acceptable, or worthy just as we are. We unconsciously assume we have less value and power. Although it's a basic human need to feel love and acceptance, these painful beliefs make it difficult to affirm ourselves. So instead, we look to others to validate our worth. We give our inner authority away to them by doing all we can to please them and make sure they're happy. As we try our best to be perfect so they'll give us the love and acceptance we seek, we lose connection with our authenticity. This habit of othering naturally creates deep neural grooves in our brains for fear, worry, and ruminating. It generates chronic self-consciousness, persistent anxiety, and self-doubt. We try to control what cannot be controlled. We dwell our attention on others. We wonder about what's going on with them, what they need. We dream of schemes to help them and how to win their approval. We forget about the fact that we can't control another's thoughts, feelings, and happiness, let alone their choices and actions. We worry about all the people we rely on and care about: our partner, children, parents, friends, colleagues, clients, students, teachers, and more. We worry about our pets. We worry about what will happen to our dear ones if disaster happens and the world as we know it falls apart. And all the while we're performing this emotional labor, we're disconnected from what's truly happening with ourself, our present moment authentic experience, our anchor to what's real, and our wisdom. And we are relational beings. While it's part of our true nature to feel compassion and want to relieve another's suffering, gender conditioning pulls us overboard with this. As girls, we're encouraged to center our attention on others, to be aware of their feelings, develop empathy, and to assume the major caretaking roles in the culture. Since our bodies have the amazing capacity to grow and birth another being, this may further incline us towards the transcentricity of relationships and connection. But othering warps our sense of responsibility. We become overly responsible for others and, in turn, under-responsible for ourselves. We feel compelled to help when someone's in need or unhappy. We automatically assume it's our job to step in and make things better, sometimes bending over backwards to help without being aware of our capacities or boundaries until we're exhausted. This not only stimulates tons of worry, but often affects our physical health as we ignore our basic responsibility to tend to our own well-being. On top of all of this, misogyny creates fear for our physical safety. The recent revelations of sexual harassment and abuse confirms our need to be constantly vigilant. You know how it is. Traveling alone, we check the back seat of the car before we get in. We're careful in parking garages. We avoid dark streets and passageways. And we're always alert using public transportation. And when we are abused, we not only have to deal with the actual aggression, but the painful memories, the inadequacies of the legal system, and the fear it could happen again at any time, on the street, in the workplace, or in someone's home. I'm so very grateful to all the brave women who've been stepping forward to expose and hold the abusers accountable, and for the multitude of women around the world voicing their truth about sexual abuse through the Me Too movement. Hopefully, our society will soon reach a tipping point where sexual mistreatment and misogyny will no longer be tolerated. Beyond our physical safety, we worry about our attractiveness, how others feel about us, and whether we're being a good enough partner, daughter, mother, friend, worker, and citizen. We worry if we said the wrong thing, weren't loving enough or fully present, or didn't respond correctly. We worry about our jobs, our finances, and what will happen to us when we're really old. We worry about not being on top of things, not getting everything done, missing something major and making mistakes. We worry about our health and the state of our minds. The list of worries goes on and on, right? Phew! So, given our gender conditioning and the pervasiveness of sexism and misogyny, it's no wonder we experience so much more anxiety than men. All of this makes us feel insecure, anxious, and bad about ourselves. Clearly, trying to be perfect in the eyes of the others so they'll give us the security we seek only keeps us trapped in our fears, anxious and insecure, afraid of our own power, and blocked from the inner wisdom of our ultimate security, which is trusting and accepting our authentic selves just as we are in the moment. But this is what we've got then. This is our reality. And it's vital not to blame ourselves. Our minds and brains have been trained to develop deep neural grooves for running fear. And on top of this, we're living in very troubled and really dark, scary times. So what do Buddha's teachings say that can help us relate to fear skillfully so we can empower ourselves to take wise action when needed and live our lives with more freedom and ease? First of all, developing what is known in the Eightfold Path of the Four Noble Truths as wise view is essential. The Buddha said, "Just as the dawn is the forerunner and the first indication of the rising sun, so is wise view the forerunner and the first indication of wholesome states." Inherent in wise view is understanding the three principal characteristics or marks of human existence. We might call these the facts of life. They are impermanence, egolessness, and suffering. The more we can truly understand and accept these realities, the more we can relax with ourselves and with things as they actually are. Let's take impermanence first. Intellectually, we know everything is in the process of change on every dimension. This is the law of nature, the basic truth of physical existence. We witness this reality all the time. The weather continuously changes. We know everyone grows older and our bodies change. They get sick and recover, and someday life in this body will end. Relationships change, agreements change, jobs change, politics and policies change. We see how our internal weather, our thoughts, feelings, and moods continuously shift and change. Even chronic pain, when we notice it mindfully, doesn't stay exactly the same moment to moment. Everything, both within us and around us, is in process. Nothing is static and fixed. People, situations, and plans are unpredictable, uncertain. Life is dynamic. It does go up and down all the time. Our tendency to get caught up in the eight whirlwind winds of change, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute, reflects this reality. But the truth is, we lack control and predictability. We don't like uncertainty and groundlessness. The conditioned mind has a deep-seated emotional aversion to it. So we worry, plan, and scheme to make things be how we want them to be. We may eat well, go to the gym, meditate, and do all we can to hold off the body's physical decay. But the body has its own way, and we can't prevent every illness or control the effect of time on our bodies or brains. We try to be the very best we can be in our relationships, in our work, in our community life, and we can't control outcomes and other people's responses to us. Clearly, the more we can truly accept impermanence, the more ease and less anxiety we'll feel with the realities of life. I do find it helpful to remind myself of the pleasant side of impermanence. Winter changes to spring and then summer. Thank goodness. The shorter, darker days do change for longer days of light. And that scary seventh grade math and science teacher I had only lasted 1 year, not the rest of my school life. Thank goodness. The second mark of existence is egolessness or selflessness. This is the reality that who we take ourselves to be is not actually as solid and permanent as it appears. We are as impermanent as everything else. But because we believe the stories our minds spin about who we are, or should be, or shouldn't be, we suffer from the illusion that we are a permanent fixed self. Our sense of self, our ego, is formed around these stories, and we mistakenly believe them to be the truth of who we are. So when our inner critic slams us with charges like, I'm selfish, I'm too needy, I'm a nervous Nelly, I'm too controlling, I'm not enough, our habit is to bow down to these views. We're caught in ego whenever we're frustrated and annoyed, justified in denigrating ourselves or others, feeling envious, jealous, or comparing ourselves to others. This habit of conceit hurts us no matter which direction it goes. Thinking we're worse than, better than, or the same as the other keeps us caught in this and feeling painfully separate and isolated. It's the breeding ground for self-consciousness. When we cling to these ideas of ourselves as solid and unchangeable, yet in reality we are actually fluid and changing, we limit ourselves and we suffer. One of fear's great gifts is that it points directly to where we're clinging to these fixed views of self. Fear is about what will happen to me, my body, my life, or my loved ones. Fears of pain, embarrassment, criticism, loss of approval from others, and losses of all kinds are rooted in these egoic ideas about a me. So realizing these ideas are all constructed and aren't actually real can offer great relief from the ego's impossible demands for perfection and control. So nothing and no one is fixed. We are as dynamic as everything else in nature. Every moment our experience is shifting and changing. We can see this so clearly when we're meditating. As we rest in open awareness and observe the moment-to-moment changing flow of experience, we see how thoughts arise and create stories about what will happen to a me that are wonderful or awful. And each time we can pop out of these stories and return attention to the breath, we experience moments of egolessness, of non-self, as we rest in the freedom of our true spacious nature. This doesn't mean we don't exist, of course, but letting go of these rigid and incorrect ideas about who we take ourselves to be is deeply freeing and helps us move through life with more ease and natural access to our wisdom and compassion. It helps our minds and hearts become more flexible, accept and loosen up with ourselves as we are, and be more playful, curious, and authentic, not knowing how we're going to respond or how we'll feel about what occurs next. It helps us relax without being so certain about who we are or who others are either. And this is profoundly freeing. The third marker of human existence is suffering or dissatisfaction. The first noble truth. There is dukkha in life. Life is difficult. There is pain and loss. As Suzuki Roshi famously put it, it is only by practicing through a continual succession of agreeable and disagreeable situations that we acquire true strength. To the extent that we can accept that pain is inherent as a part of life, we actually create the conditions for our happiness. I'll never forget the time I was in a study group learning tools for personal growth, when one member of the group who'd recovered from the ending of a long-term relationship said she was now feeling attracted to someone, but she didn't want to get hurt again. Hearing this, the teacher asked all of us to stand up and form a circle. She then stood squarely in front of this woman and said, Jane, you are a human being. You will get hurt. Then she moved to the next person and said, Lonnie, you're a human being. You will get hurt. Moving to the next person, she said, Michael, you are a human being. You will get hurt. And around the circle she went, standing in front of each person and telling each one they will get hurt. Mare, you are a human being, you will get hurt. The obvious truth of this greatly impressed me. It inspired me to learn how to experience pain without suffering and to build confidence in being able to weather pain. It is undeniably true. We have all been hurt. We all will get hurt. As long as we are alive, we will experience pain. It's not possible to avoid it. But we do forget this first noble truth over and over. I've heard Pema children say so many, many times, as human beings, we should never underestimate our preference for the pleasant. We create suffering for ourselves when we forget about impermanence and instead expect things to be predictable and unchanging. And we forget that we are as impermanent and unchanging as everything else. We aren't fixed and solid. We aren't separate from everything else. Instead, we're all interconnected, and our true nature is egoless, fluid, and flexible. We forget that we can learn to be with pain without suffering, both physical and emotional. This is one of the most remarkable gifts of mindfulness. So fear is really our great teacher. When something seems threatening, it gets us to pay attention and take action. It has vital information that can help us grow. Even though it's uncomfortable, it activates us. But precisely because fear is so uncomfortable, we tend to view it as the problem. But the problem is not fear. The problem is our relationship to it, our habitual judgment, resistance, and aversion. The problem is our fear of fear. When we're avoiding fear, it rules us. It shuts us down. Our whole system contracts in the attempt to not feel it. We say to ourselves, don't think about it, don't talk about it, just ignore it. How many times have you not admitted that you were scared about something? But being unconscious to fear's hold on us prevents us from learning from it and moving through it. It disempowers us. We're cut off from our wisdom and lack the discernment to see if our fears are valid or not. We can't tell which fears to respect and which to shrug off, which is the essential task with fear. Is this a real threat or not? That's the primary question. Further, denying fear shrinks our life. We make choices to avoid whatever triggers it, but that only locks the fear in place. Paradoxically, by trying not to feel fear, it actually dominates and torments us. And what we don't feel, we can't heal. I had a powerful experience with resisting fear not too long ago. When I finally finished the manuscript of my book, Unshakable Confidence, and sent it off to Sharon Salzberg for her feedback and possible endorsement, I felt tremendous relief and joy. And my spouse and I then took off on a much-needed vacation. As we headed to the North Woods and Lake Superior, I realized that I was actually going to publish this book and offer it out to the world. And this was a dream come true. Super, super exciting for me. And I also felt a brief twinge of fear, which I quickly pushed down because, after all, I was now on vacation and I really needed to relax and have a whole bunch of fun. After I returned from vacation and was waiting for Sharon's feedback, I gradually noticed I felt as though I was living in a dark cloud. I felt unusually grumpy and irritable, low energy, and strangely blah. Everything seemed like a struggle. I didn't feel like working or doing much of anything. Then one morning in meditation, I observed my mind creating the depressing thought, gee, maybe it would just be better not to be here. I was startled by this thought, and so I decided to investigate it. As I inquired more deeply, I discovered a whole lot of fear I'd been steadily ignoring. All kinds of very old fears had gotten provoked. Fears about revealing myself to others in a brand new way. My ideas and experiences with mindfulness, my understanding of Buddhism and women's psychology. This was a whole new coming out for me, and my egoic mind was freaked, running very scary stories. I imagined Sharon and my other teachers shaking their heads sadly and saying, gee, Mir, you really don't understand this practice and philosophy at all. You have no business teaching this. I imagined nameless women laughing at what I'd written, rolling their eyes in dismay and tossing the book aside. I heard my judging mind loudly declaring that I was a fraud and had absolutely nothing to offer, and I felt humiliated, anxious, and depressed. As I realized these very dramatic, upsetting stories, it was obvious why I thought it would be easier to simply not be here. Believing these stories was creating a lot of deep pain and massive self-doubt. Now understanding my mind state, I turned toward the sensations these thoughts created in my body and practiced cradling all of them spaciously and compassionately. And as I let this all be, I recognized their roots in my conditioning and could see the stories clearly as illusions and not the truth. They were all about conditioned ideas of self, old familiar painful beliefs about not being good enough, about not being legitimate. So I then asked myself, well, what would be a wise and kind way to respond to myself? What do I truly need then? As I listened deeply, after a few moments I heard, to remember to trust my authentic self and practice what I've been writing about, unshakable confidence. Oh yes, of course. How ironic and funny to see that my mind had been caught up in intensive othering and was clinging to these old ideas of self. Processing the fears this way, my energy returned and I felt like my brighter self again. Thank goodness. So, given fear is such a powerful teacher, and resistance and denial holds us hostage to it in suffering, how can we use mindfulness to relate to it skillfully? Regardless of the stimulus of fear, whether in response to news of another blow to democracy and social justice by the powers that be, or it's arising from internalized beliefs about self-doubt and inadequacy, the first step is always awareness. We need to recognize fear when we feel it. This is our first act of bravery. Whatever version is here, a flicker of nervousness, worry, butterflies in the stomach, apprehension, or a stronger zap, we turn towards it and note it. Here's anxiety. Here's worry. Here's feeling nervous. Yup, fear is here. Remember, there's no shame in feeling fear. It's normal to feel it. It's inherent in being alive. And even though it's often misguided or out of date, fear is trying to protect us. So please be kind and realize it's great that you're now spotting it. Next, we bring attention fully into the present moment and ground in what's actually real right now. The present moment is a natural antidote to fear. It's a refuge for the fearful mind. Unless we're about to get hit by a bus in the next second, fear is always about the future, a future event appearing real. So breathing several breaths mindfully moves attention out of the scary story into what's actually real now, the sensations of the body breathing. The more we can use all of our senses to fully connect with the present moment, the more inner stability we have to face the fearful state. This gathers our wits about us. And sometimes this move alone is enough to allow the mind to release its grip on the story and the sensations ease. Oh yes, present moment. What my mind imagined is not happening now. Thank goodness for that. Next, if the feeling remains, we open to it with as much curiosity as we can muster. We want to discover exactly how we are experiencing this, both the scary story and the sensations the story creates. Although fear is created by our thoughts, we're usually not aware of the story at first, just the uncomfortable feeling of it. So we ask ourselves, what was I just imagining that was so scary? What was I telling myself? What movie was my mind running? Remember, a thought is only a thought, nothing more. The mind thinks. This is what it does. Some of our thoughts are useful, profound, wise, and constructive. And many are not. Our job as practitioners is to be discerning and cut through the illusions of the mind. So we ask ourselves, is this thought, is this story true? Is there real danger right now? Is this arising from an external event or from a conditioned internal pattern? And does this story serve me right now? And if not, our task is to let it go. This inquiry into the mind's story is key because it informs skillful action. If we realize our fear is a reaction to a worldly event, we'll need to assess how much power we have to affect change and what actions we can take that are within reach. If it's generated by gender conditioning and fears of self-doubt and unworthiness, we need to find a wise and kind way to respond to these incorrect ideas of ourself. Either way, though, moving attention from the story to the sensations in the body is the next key step. This releases our grip on the story and interrupts the habit of creating more add-on scary thoughts. And while thoughts are actually super light, changeable, and have no real substance of their own, dissolving quickly when we shift attention away from them, sensations have a longer shelf life. So it's important to ask, where do I feel this in my body right now? What are the sensations actually like? And we open to them with lots of kindness and compassion. Investigating the precise qualities of the sensations with beginner's mind, tons of curiosity. This helps sustain attention and refrain from being pulled back into the mind's scary imaginings. This takes bravery, of course. We don't like these feelings of fear. They're very unpleasant. But if we can remember they're impermanent and there's freedom to be gained here, we can empower ourselves to stay steady and learn. Then, once the feeling, the sensation is all scoped out, we gently cradle it spaciously in our awareness, letting it be just as it is and encouraging ourselves to relax around it. And as we let it be, it may simply dissipate and dissolve. But if the sensation lingers, and especially if the fear is rooted in our conditioning, because we're creating favorable inner conditions for accessing our personal data banks, there's potential for deeper understanding. So by asking, when have I felt this before? Or how old do I feel right now feeling this? An insight may arise about what this is really about. Perhaps it's rooted in a belief or a conclusion we made about ourselves or others when we were younger that no longer serves us. Lastly, no matter what event provoked this, it's always useful to ask, well, given all of this, what's a wise and kind way to respond to myself? What do I really need now? Here we are tapping directly into the wisdom, kindness, and intelligence of our true nature, listening deeply to whatever advice bubbles up. We're accessing our deep knowing of ourselves. One other principle that is vital to practice every step of the way as we work with fear mindfully is to disidentify with our experience. The conditioned mind habit of taking everything personally keeps us velcroed to ideas of self and caught in the mind's painful stories. The tool of softly noting interrupts this habit. It cultivates egolessness. So we label what we're noticing without using any personal pronouns. We say, here's anxiety, here's feeling scared, instead of I'm anxious or I'm scared. We note bodily sensations the same way. Here's tightness in the belly, sweating palms, heart beating faster. This creates instant spaciousness. We observe the experience of fear instead of being fear. This spaciousness, free from attachment to a self, makes room for our wisdom to come through and for our impermanence to naturally have its way. Recently, a woman told me of a profound experience she had bringing mindfulness to fear. Her dearest and best friend of over 40 years battled cancer for many years and had finally died. Long before she died, her friend had asked her to speak at her funeral. Of course, being best friends, she agreed, even though she had always been terrified of speaking in public. As the memorial service approached, her dread and anxiety about speaking increased. She began waking every morning feeling intense fear, and she would do all she could to push it down and shake it off. Finally, on the morning of the service, she awoke in a panic with overwhelming fear. And because the service was now imminent, she decided she'd be wise to open to it mindfully. She said it felt like there was a huge red cauldron of agitated, angry, bubbling liquid fire in her belly. She practiced in the way I've described, saw the stories where she imagined making a massive fool of herself, investigated the uncomfortable sensations with curiosity, recalled memories of a younger self and the old beliefs she held, and discovered what she really needed from herself, which was to feel her love for her friend. And then suddenly the red-hot bubbling liquid in her belly transformed into perfectly still, calm, cool, clear water. Not a ripple on its surface. The fear was gone. She felt stable, peaceful, confident. She spoke spontaneously at the service without any notes in front of 200 people from her calm, open, and loving heart. So fear is our friend, our ally, and our great teacher. as uncomfortable feelings get our attention so we can take wise action when we feel threatened. Certainly with the events of these times and fears that arise from our conditioning, we have plenty of opportunity to develop our friendship with fear. Through accepting the realities of impermanence, egolessness, and suffering, and by working with fear mindfully, we can learn to appreciate fear instead of fear it. As the wise Sufi poet reminds us, don't turn away. Keep your eye on the bandaged place. That's where the light enters you. As we open bravely to it, the alchemy of mindfulness can heal us from old, incorrect conditioned views that fuel our fear and keep us trapped in feeling small and powerless. With practice, we can gradually build trust in our authentic selves, discover what wise actions we can take to empower ourselves and help our world. And as we do so, the unshakable confidence that we can handle whatever arises grows deeper in us. I'd like to end with a poem by Marianne Williamson. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There's nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We are all meant to shine, as children do. We were born to manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. Let's sit for a few minutes together.